I can always tell when I've been at the seminary for a couple of days, my knees start to hurt. It's a very good sign. Keeps a man humble. And we're going to be talking about pride and humility today. So I've fallen behind schedule, but I want to try to keep to some sort of schedule. So I'm going to try to cover Oedipus Rex in the two lectures this morning. This won't be easy to do. I'll be moving rather swiftly. Let me give one bit of advice. I've just sort of been glancing around as you came in, and I know there are about 8 different translations of the play floating around out there. This is the difficulty of dealing with literature and translation. And because I'm going to be moving so swiftly, I'm going to be working from one particular translation. I'll be doing some reading. It will be very clear to you which scene it is I'm dealing with. Don't go looking for specific lines or you're just going to be lost, because they're not necessarily the same. This version that many of you have was done for the stage. It's a stage version, which means the poet translator who did it pared it down to its bare bones so it would have quick action, move swiftly on the stage. And also he was aware the modern ear can't take a lot of poetry. It's very difficult for the modern ear to grab. The one I'm going to be using, and it's more literary, I'm not sure it could be used on the stage, is one that goes almost line for line, almost line for line in terms of translation. So I'm going to be working from this one. In any case, you'll know where I am. I'll specify where I am. You can make a note of it and then check on your own later if you want to refer back to a scene. I think it will simply make it easier. Let me just repeat the great line of American poet Robert Frost, who said, "Poetry is what gets lost in translation." And for that reason, sadly, we will be neglecting the poetic side of Oedipus Rex and emphasizing the dramatic and the thematic, but we'll make up for that when we come to Hamlet, as some of you are already learning to your peril if you've been busy trying to scan sonnet number 71. We're going to get into the nuts and bolts of poetry, but in our own language, or at least what was once our language. It's changed a bit. Let me begin this morning with my own personal definition of tragedy. This is the one I give to all my classes. This isn't Aristotle's. Aristotle's is much better and more inclusive. The definition I'm giving is more practical, and I use it as a kind of a guide for my students so they have something to hold on to and something to look for when they're reading almost any tragedy. Here it is. Tragedy is a drama in which the central conflict is between the tragic hero and forces larger than the human. So we start with a basic conflict. All drama is conflict. But this conflict is between the hero and forces that are somehow larger than the merely human. In tragedy, we have a great man. We have to start with a great hero, or it can be a great heroine. There are many, many great tragedies, Medea, Phaedra, many of them that deal with women. A great man, a great woman, who has a tragic flaw. In spite of the greatness, there is a flaw in the character, okay? So a great man with a tragic flaw, who makes a tragic mistake, or a tragic choice. It is quite possible to be great and have a flaw and deal with it and survive. That's not the stuff of tragedy. Tragedy is greatness that has a flaw and makes a mistake, makes a tragic choice. So there's a moment of decision when that choice is made that leads to the hero's downfall. That's the next part. That tragic hero has a fall. There is a tragic fall. I'll come back to that in a moment. It's the reason why we need nobility. It's the reason why it cannot just be, for example, a salesman. And as a result of the tragic fall, the hero gains knowledge. Always, always, in spite of the miserable circumstances in which the hero finds himself following his mistake and fall, he has gained something from it. There is a gain in terms of his own wisdom. So we're in tragedy. We're at that curious crux of a complex Christian idea, which is the fortunate fall. That somehow by falling you are better off. And the tragic hero has gained something by the end of the play because of that flaw. Okay? So a conflict between a great man and larger forces in which the man cannot win. Tragic flaw, a tragic mistake, a fall, and the gaining of knowledge. That's just a pattern that can be applied to almost any tragedy. Let me just talk for a moment, very briefly. Tragedy depends on hierarchy. It is impossible to write a democratic tragedy. I'm not very fond of Death of a Salesman. I've seen good productions of it on a couple of occasions. It can be moving. It's not a favorite play of mine, but it can be moving. It is the story of a pathetic man. It raises a kind of sorrow. We feel sorry for him. It's not tragedy. Why not? Why is greatness necessary? Why is hierarchy necessary? First and foremost, because we have to. In speaking of greatness, I'm speaking of greatness in social terms too. Okay? Again, not just a salesman, and Willie Loman in the Arthur Miller play is just an average guy. There's nothing great about him. But you could have a great salesman. Not sufficient. Not sufficient. The greatness has to be connected with position. There has to be hierarchy. Why? First and foremost, because we as audience have to look up to the man. There has to be the sense of superiority. There has to be the sense that we're viewing someone bigger, more powerful, better than ourselves. Why is that important? In order to rouse what Aristotle called fear. The point being, if someone that great can fall, if someone that important and impressive can fall, what chance do I have as just a little twerpy guy? And therefore, part of the creation of the fear of the tragedy is watching someone of enormous gifts, enormous power, great consequence and circumstance, who falls, and also, obviously, hierarchy, someone at the top of that ladder, can really fall. There is no doubt when we look at Oedipus, this man who is the most powerful man in Thebes stumbles out of the village at the end. Blinded, broken, humiliated. That's a fall. Willie Loman losing his job is too bad. It is not the equivalent of what Oedipus goes through. It is not the equivalent of what Hamlet goes through. And that descent from the high position to lowliness is indeed, again, something that shocks us to the core. But it is an appropriate response to watch a great man who undergoes that, okay? It's very important. So first you need the greatness in terms of character so that we have a model we can look at that in falling can inspire a genuine fear in us. And number two, that fall, in order to be significant, has to be a fall of some consequence. And therefore, there has to be that ordering. There has to be that ordering. It is very simple. You cannot have tragedy without hierarchy. It is the reason why the one truly great American tragedy, that book about the whale, is set on a sailing vessel, and you have a captain. You have a figure of real prominence and a crew under him that is ranked. And the confrontations between Captain Ahab and his first mate Starbuck are still hierarchical and become very important in the structure of the book. Melville instinctively, because he had a tragic spirit, didn't set his tragedy in a shoe store in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He put it out on a boat where there had to be a hierarchy. And it has its effect, and as a result, he gets a real tragedy. That's just a basic definition. There's one thing I would add. In the definition, I have said that the basic conflict is between a great man and larger forces, okay? The point I am making in that definition is that tragedy is metaphysical by nature. It deals with grand ideas. Comedy is social by nature. It deals with man and society. Interestingly enough, we are starting with tragedy, and later next week, we're going to move much more into the realm of comedy, although serious comedy. The Moviegoer is a comedy, a serious comedy. Flannery O'Connor's Revelation is a comedy, a serious comedy, but nevertheless comedy. But they are metaphysical comedies, which is very difficult to do and very unusual to do. It's something that's turning up more and more in our time. But that's for next week. You still, however, in nature of the conflict in the action, need two old-fashioned terms. You need a protagonist and an antagonist, okay? Just in order to keep the plot moving. Think of it as a good guy and a bad guy. You need that basic conflict at the core of the action. You need a hero, and you need someone who stands in opposition to that hero. This is part of the greatness of Oedipus Rex, in that everything in the play is so unified that it moves back to the central figure. Part of the complexity and greatness, and I'll get into this in just a moment, of this play, is that in Sophocles' tragedy of Oedipus Rex, the protagonist is Oedipus Rex, obviously. Oedipus and the king, he is the hero. Who is he fighting against? The antagonist is that murderer of King Laius, who has brought shame, scandal, plague, and death on the city of Thebes. And at the beginning of the play, Oedipus says, I will find that man, I will root him out, I will punish him, he is my enemy, he is the enemy of the city of Thebes. And who is the antagonist? It's Oedipus Rex. It is a brilliant, right from the start, in terms of looking at the basic conflict, we have an enormously complex and yet unified action in terms of the central conflict. In that the main character, the protagonist, who declares himself in opposition to this unknown other figure, is declaring war on himself. He is saying at the beginning of the play, I will find this man, root him out, I will punish him, he will be destroyed for what he has done and what he has brought on the city. This is not easy to do. The reason it works, and the reason that Sophocles is able to do it, is because of his design, the way he has put the play together. And that's what I'd like to start with at this point. Let me give you a possible date for Oedipus Rex. Probably 427 B.C. We know it came shortly after 430 B.C. We're not sure exactly of the year. I choose 427 because it's my house address back in Eau Claire. It's as good as 428 or 429, and it's easier for me to remember. So it written in approximately 427 B.C. As I said yesterday, we know it was one part of a trilogy, but we don't know what the other two parts were. There has been some speculation. It assumes that perhaps one part of it was Oedipus meeting with the Sphinx, the encounter with the Sphinx. We don't know for certain, but this was one part. It is hard to imagine how the other plays could have been as brilliant and as unified as this one. Sophocles took the basic myth. He knew the audience would have that myth in their mind. A myth is one of those stories that is so basic and so well known at a given time that everyone knows the story even if they've never read the work. Okay? It's just, it's everybody knows it. It's there. I don't want to go through the full story, but I do want to make a point, which is this. We have, in terms of the Oedipus myth, and actually a fairly long story. Quick rundown, okay? Before the birth of the hero, Laius and Jocasta, the king and queen of Thebes, are told by Apollo at Delphi that their son will kill its father, okay? So they send the infant out when it's born, its feet pierced with metal pins, to be abandoned and die on the mountainside. The shepherd, of course, instead gives it to another shepherd. We see both of those characters in the play, who takes it to the other side of the mountain of Kithaeron, the mountain range between Thebes and Corinth. And the child is given to the king and queen of Corinth, Polybus and Merope. They adopt it because they are childless. The name Oedipus means swell-footed, okay? Because of those metal spikes that were put in his feet as a child. Dipus in Greek suggests also 2 feet, okay? 2 swollen feet. The first part of the name, interesting enough, OID, the OID phrase is an adaptation from the Greek for knowledge, having wisdom, okay? It is, if you will, a two-footed knower. A two-footed knower. The name is obviously somehow connected from the beginning with the story itself. When he is a grown man, a guest tells him that he's not the true son of the royal house of Corinth. Foster parents try to reassure him. He goes to Delphi to ask the oracle. He's told by the oracle he will kill his father and marry his mother. Horrifying prophecy. He resolves he will never return to Corinth. He will avoid the prophecy. And so he goes out, leaves, and at a place where three roads meet on his journey, he quarrels with an old man over the right-of-way, kills the old man, who is, of course, Laius. He comes down to the plain of Thebes, which is being oppressed by the Sphinx. Anyone who cannot answer the riddle of the Sphinx is devoured by it, and Thebes is held in terror by the Sphinx. We'll get to the riddle later. He answers the riddle. The Sphinx, in despair, destroys itself. Thebes is freed from the curse. He is welcomed into Thebes. He becomes king of Thebes. He marries the queen, whose husband has been murdered, and settles down to a long and happy life. They have children together, and all is well. That's the story, okay? Up until the point where we enter into it in the play. I want to make this point. Sophocles' focus in his play is not on the breaking of those taboos, okay? The murdering of the father and the marrying with the mother are horrible events. But please notice, that is not where the action of the play is located. That's part of the story. And of course, that gets included, and that is information that lands on the hero during the course of the play. But in arranging the action, that is not what Sophocles is focusing on. He is not showing any of that happen. The focus in this play, and it's the reason Aristotle calls it a model of theatrical plotting, through ferocious logic and inexorable movement forward, we are focusing on the moment of the discovery of truth. This play is about the discovery of truth, not the violations of the taboos. Although, of course, the truth that is discovered is, I killed my father, I married my mother. Horrifying truth. But what Sophocles is looking at is a man in ignorance trying to gain wisdom and coming to the truth, and the truth is horrifying. But more than that, it's even better, it's better constructed than that. What we have here is the first murder mystery. I mentioned yesterday how I spent years of my young life reading murder mysteries by the thousands. I know something about murder mysteries. Oedipus Rex is the best murder mystery ever written. Why? Because the detective who is out there trying to find out who the murderer is actually the murderer and doesn't know it. This is incredible plotting, and Sophocles gets away with it. Let me put it this way. Think of it again as a criminal case, okay? The investigator who is out there looking for the murderer turns into the prosecutor and also the final judge and the executioner. Murderer, investigator, detective, prosecutor, judge, executioner. They're all the same man. They are all the same man. What in any other work of art has to be divided up. In this work of art, because the way Sophocles has structured it, all become one. All exist within the title character. It's an amazing piece of construction. From Aristotle's time to the present day, it's simply the best arrangement of plot anybody has ever done. There have been more complex plots, okay, pulling many, many strands together, but the unity of the action here is remarkable. We also have, by virtue of the Greek stage, unity of place. We only have the one set. The whole thing takes place in front of the palace of Thebes, and we have what's called the unity of time. How long does it take for the action of the events that are unfolding as long as it takes for the play to run its course. The play runs about an hour and 20 minutes if it's done at a fairly good tempo. How long does it take for the actual story to unfold? An hour and 20 minutes. The play and the events of the play are exactly the same. We're not hopping all over the place. We don't have huge expanses of time. This, by the way, is something that Shakespeare will do. And he was criticized for, even by some of his fellow playwrights, that he broke all the unities. Will in a single play, his Antony and Cleopatra, we're bouncing back and forth between Alexandria and Rome. We're all over the known world. The amount of time, years can go by. In order to prove that he himself could pull this off, his last play is perfectly unified, observes all the unities, the tempest. We're on one little island, we've got one action, and it takes place in the running time of the play. At the end of his career, Shakespeare said, see, I could do it if I wanted to. Sophocles does it naturally, and no play ever written is better unified than Oedipus Rex. It observes those unities perfectly. What have we got here? We have, then, a highly emotional drama of grand human passions that has been constructed very reasonably. I'll go back to Aristotle's argument yesterday that poetry is not just inspiration. Sophocles had to sit down and use his brain in order to put this thing together. This is exceedingly well constructed. It is, if you will, a reasonable, rational act of construction, like building a very fine chair. Okay? It's craftsmanship on one level, and it's magnificent craftsmanship. We also see that reason, that rationality working in Oedipus. He is a good detective. He is ferreting out clues. He is piecing information together. He is trying to come up with the solution to the murder. Who killed Laius? And all the time he's doing it, he is circling closer and closer to the condemnation of himself. And it is very frightening. We'll look at some of that in just a bit. I don't want to play down the shocking aspects of the play. I was lucky enough to be in a production of it many, many years ago as an undergraduate at the university. I had a wonderful role, one of those roles that an actor loves. I got to be the guy that, the messenger that comes out of the palace and tells what went on inside. Jocasta hanging herself, Oedipus blinding himself. You come out and give that big speech of absolute horror, and then you get to go sit in the dressing room and, you know, have a can of pop or something. It's an actor's dream. You know, you've got your one big moment and it's the high point of the play and then you get to go and rest. We were doing it and this is a true story. The basketball coach at the university came to see the play because one of his players was in the chorus and was so horrified at the plot. He'd never heard the story. He didn't know what it was about. Was so horrified at the thought of this man who's killed his father, married his mother, and had children with her, that he stood up in the middle of the performance he was at and was shouting, "This is disgusting! This is horrible!" and went stomping out of the theater. It still has shock value, okay? It can still move. I'm told the story by my predecessor who ran the drama program at the Naval Academy. He did Oedipus years ago. And back then, all plays had to be approved by the commandant's office. So a young Navy lieutenant called him up to check out this play. He had been announced for the fall season. He said, "Now you're doing this Oedipus here." And he said, "No, it's Oedipus. It's Oedipus Rex." "Now is this a weird name?" He says, "Well, it's a Greek play." And he said, "I noticed here you've only listed their first names. Don't any of these people have last names?" And he said, no, it's a Greek play. They just go by one name." He says, "Oh," he says, now tell me, I don't have time to read this thing. What's it basically about?" My colleague starts going through the plot, and as he goes on, the guy on the other end of the phone is getting quieter and quieter, and finally says, "Professor, what kind of disgusting play are you putting on over there?" There was one last question, which was, he said, "Now I see here you've got a chorus listed. Are you going to want the Navy band to back them up?" It remains my dream to someday do a production of Oedipus with chorus and Navy band. they can play Anchors Away as he goes off at the end of the play. Point being, it's still a shocker. Plot-wise, it is still a shocker to those who don't know. It stirs something primal. It's the reason why, and I will just, let me dismiss this quickly. It's the reason why in our own time it became a favorite of Sigmund Freud, the first of the psychoanalysts. There is always a tiny little grain of truth in Freud, just blown out of all proportion. And just to show you how silly this is from Freud's comments on Oedipus Rex. His destiny moves us only because it might have been ours, because the oracle laid the same curse upon us before our birth as upon him. It is the fate of all of us to direct our first sexual impulse towards our mother and our first hatred and our first murderous wish against our father. Our dreams convince us that this is so. I have never encountered anyone who's dreamed of killing his father and marrying his mother. I mean, I keep asking. I've never encountered anyone. And Freud makes it a universal statement, saying that this is something we have all wanted to do and dreamed about. When I was a young liberal, I thought, is there something wrong with me that I didn't have these dreams? It never occurred to me. I mean, you know, there are times you'd get a little irritated or be fond of mummy, but again, it gets blown into this. No, the whole point of Oedipus is this is a violation of something that is normal. That is the love for the father and the maternal love between mother and son. That's what's violated. If you, as Freud does in that essay, make it a universal, that's what we all want to do, then there's no shock. Then Oedipus has simply done what everybody wanted to do. And that's, in a twisted, perverse way, he then becomes heroic. Freud just misses the mark. I dismiss him. No, the point is, this is a violation of that which is normal. This really is. This is something he would not have done under any circumstances, and hence the nightmare that he finds himself in. Now, a couple of other things I need to do before we get to the play itself. And that is the background in which the play was written. I mentioned yesterday in distinguishing among the great Greek playwrights that Aeschylus is the one who, without any questions, defends the divine order. It is unquestioning. Mankind's role is to simply submit. The divine order is there. The gods have decreed you submit to them. In Sophocles, we find someone who is wrestling with these questions, okay? And that is what is happening precisely in this play. There is the sense, and it was happening at the time that Sophocles was writing, that the first attacks were being made on the whole notion of the divine as it had been accepted in Athens. Specifically under attack was prophecy. And why was this important? Simply this. That shrine of Apollo at Delphi, from which the voice of the god Apollo spoke to man, through which the prophecies were given by Apollo the great prophet, was central to the beliefs of the Athenians. That was, I mean, they worshipped many gods, but the shrine at Delphos with Apollo was of huge importance because there resided the voice of the prophet. The translator of this edition, a very fine classical scholar named Robert Fagles, makes the following statement. What did it mean to attack prophecy? If the case for divine foreknowledge could be successfully demolished, the whole traditional religious edifice went down with it. If the gods did not know the future, they did not know any more than man. And please notice that what we get in the way this play is constructed is a challenge to prophecy. There are characters all along who are challenging the prophetic vision. Why does it matter? It matters for that very reason. Because if the gods are just speaking gibberish and really don't know, They lack any sort of superior knowledge, and man becomes the equivalent of the gods. This is an attack on the divine. It is a deliberate attack on the divine. For that reason, throughout the play, the oracle at Delphi is in the background. It is always there. It is a presence. It is from that oracle that the first prophecy was made to Laius and Jocasta. It was from that shrine at Delphi that the oracle spoke to Oedipus and told him he would kill his father and marry his mother, which is why he left Corinth. It is to that shrine that Oedipus, before the play has begun, has sent Creon to find out what is causing the plague in Thebes. Something is wrong in Thebes. They can't figure out what it is. And out of desperation, they turn to that source of divine wisdom, which is the oracle. And at the very beginning of the play, we'll look at the scene in a little bit, Creon comes back from the oracle at Delphi, and the oracle says, what? This plague has fallen on the city because the king was murdered and the murderer is still at large. You have not done justice to your dead king. And hence the gods are sending this plague. That word comes from the oracle at Delphi. Prophecy is then attacked in the figure of Tiresias. It is one of the great dramatic scenes in all of dramatic literature. The old prophet is brought in. He wanders the countryside. He is the oldest of the prophets. And what he does, what he gives voice to, and again we'll look at the scene in a moment, is simply to restate what the oracle has already said, but he puts it directly on the head of Oedipus. You're the murderer, you did it, and you are living in a situation in that palace in Thebes that you don't want to know about, buddy. It's really awful. Okay? Again, the prophecy comes, and we have them, a whole series of characters who discredit or dismiss the oracle. Actually, I'm going to take this opportunity and run through it right now, okay? Let's just look at some of them. The point I'm simply making is this. This is, in one sense, the background of the play. This is the background of the play. And it is hugely, hugely important in understanding where we are and what is going on. Okay. First reference, it comes at the beginning of the play, very beginning, Oedipus speaking to the priest. I'm going to look at the structure of this later. I'm going to run through this in a couple of different ways with different vantage points. He's talking about his own pain for the city. He too has wept for Thebes. He too is worried about Thebes. After a painful search, I found one cure. I acted at once. I sent Creon, my wife's own brother, to Delphi. Apollo, the prophet's oracle, to learn what I might do or say to save our city. At this moment, at the beginning of the play, Oedipus is humbling himself to that oracle. I'm helpless. I've done everything I can do. What can I do? I humble myself to the oracle. The oracle is supreme. Therefore, I've sent. We're going to find out. I'm going to find out what must be done. It's very interesting. Later, when the accusation is made against Creon, Tiresias says, you're the problem. You're the murderer. And Oedipus turns on Creon, his brother-in-law, says, you set that guy up, didn't you? You told him to say that. Creon says, do you want proof? Go to Delphi yourself. Examine the oracle and see if I've reported the message word for word. This too. If you detect that I and the clairvoyant have plotted anything in common, arrest me. Execute me. Go to the oracle. I reported it accurately. Talk to the prophet. I didn't collude with the prophet. The prophet came in here and told you the truth. Don't blame me. But notice what is happening. Doubt. Doubt. Doubt that at this moment is directed against the human agent, Creon, against the visible prophet, Tiresias,
But as Oedipus begins to be told the truth, he turns against the tellers of the truth. And we see the pride in the man growing as it is revealed to him what his situation actually is. Point being, he doesn't want to know. We may claim to want self-knowledge. We may claim to want to know what we are really like. We may claim to wish for that information about what makes us operate, what makes us run, what our actual status in the world is, but Sophocles knew full well, you start telling people the truth, and they're going to turn on you savagely. Witness the president and American public's reaction to Ken Starr. Okay? And the more graphic and direct the truth, the greater the anger. And that is what is happening in Oedipus. And the response of the public is the same. Shut these folks up. Forget the oracle. Forget the prophet. Forget the whole thing. We don't want to hear anymore. And simultaneously, the ruler's pride grows. Until finally, Jocasta enters. I ended the lecture yesterday with a little joke of Aristotle's about womankind. There is the complaint lodged against the Greeks now that they were misogynistic. They hated women. Why? Because they kept them in the home to raise the family. I would simply say Aristotle's comment that presentation of character should be appropriate. And when he said, therefore, women should be presented as womanly, as not manlike and not clever, is really a compliment. And what it means is each thing must be true to its nature. And it is a recognition of the true nature of woman, and his understanding of that womanhood is made very clear in the portrait of Jocasta he draws. A magnificent character. Womanly, affectionate, motherly, a devoted wife, we get the full range, but of course, she too has an awful truth she has to learn. But the other thing that he presents in her that is absolutely true and vivid is she will do anything to protect her family, her husband, her children, her home. Anything. I just love it. I must tell you, the very next passage I'm going to read begins with, there, you see? I love it. Jocasta speaking, Apollo brought neither thing to pass. My baby no more murdered his father than Laius suffered his wildest fear, death at his own son's hands. That's how the seers and all their revelations mapped out the future. She dismisses the divine oracles. Because they're wrong. They got it wrong. They're spouting absolute nonsense. And almost instantaneously, we get the same thing. Oedipus goes back and begins talking about the message he received from the oracle, and very soon he's saying, well, it seems to be questionable, you know. There are real questions here as to whether or not the oracle is accurate, and then the chorus steps in. This is the great choral ode right before the messenger, the first messenger. I'm going to distinguish between those two servants that come in. The messenger, the one who took the baby to the king and queen of Corinth, and the shepherd, the last to appear, who takes the child from the house of Laius and passes it on to the messenger who takes it to Corinth, okay? The shepherd is the last chain in the link when the truth is finally forged. Right before that messenger comes in, the chorus says, never again will I go reverent to Delphi, the inviolate heart of earth, or Apollo's ancient oracle at Abe, or Olympia of the fires, unless these prophecies all come true for all mankind to point toward in wonder. King of kings, if you deserve your titles, Zeus, remember, never forget, you and your deathless everlasting reign, they are dying, the old oracle sent to Laius. Now our masters strike them off the rolls. Nowhere Apollo's golden glory now. the gods go down, says the chorus. One function of the chorus, and I'll just do this very quickly here. The chorus has many functions, but one function of the chorus is to mirror in some way what is happening within the title character. Again, the reason for hierarchy. What does hierarchy do? Hierarchy makes a population dependent on a single figure. So that any tragedy with a figure of greatness who falls is not the tragedy of one man alone, but the tragedy of many. And we see it happening here. As the king and queen of Thebes come to doubt the oracle, dismiss the gods, their arrogance spreads to the chorus. The gods go down. And it means that when Oedipus falls, his fall, like ripples in a boulder going into a lake, will spread across the entire lake. No one is untouched when the great man falls. And it is, again, part of the root of the terror of tragedy, the fear it creates in us. I can simply be an average guy, Joe Sixpack, going along, doi, 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 and something that some guy above me does is going to affect me directly. Directly. And in this case, the refusal to recognize the prophecies, to recognize the God's demands, will touch the little people when Oedipus falls. At this point, they're being filled with the same arrogance. Jocasta herself dismisses, again, the oracles very quickly. So much for prophecy, it's neither here nor there. From this day on, I wouldn't look left or right. Nothing can touch me, I'm fine, I'm in control, forget the prophecies, forget the gods. And then, something that is very, really, you prophecies of the gods, where are you now? Please, notice it goes from a dismissal to an attack. You prophecies of the gods, where are you now? This is the man that Oedipus feared for years. This is the messenger. He fled him not to kill him, and now he's dead. The word has come that the king of Corinth has died. Natural causes. He didn't kill his father. Prophets are wrong. They don't know what they're talking about. Jocasta says to her husband, listen to him. See for yourself what all those awful prophecies of God have come to. Okay? They don't matter. They don't matter. The pride builds in her. Please remember, the city is still under the plague. There are no crops. The animals are dying. The children are dying. And the rulers are now getting more and more filled with pride. Jocasta again, fear, what should a man fear? It's all chance. Chance rules our lives. Not a man on earth can see a day ahead groping through the dark. Better to live at random, best we can. There's nothing new under the sun. Jocasta posits what's now called by science chaos theory. Okay. Just random motion, random particles, unpredictable. Just see what happens. Get along as best you can. It is a slap in the face of the gods, and Oedipus immediately, same things. But now all those prophecies I feared, Polybus packs them off to sleep with him in hell. They're nothing. Worthless. He's freed from the curse. Prophecies were wrong. He knows better than the gods. What do we have here? We have a standard human situation. The arrogant ruler, the man of pride, refusing to bow down humbly before the decrees of the divine. This is what was going on in Athens at the time, and Sophocles is working it out dramatically. Is working it out dramatically, okay? Now, I'll do this now. I'm going back before the play, in that there is another way in which we can view this sense of the divine and the predictions that are made. Hugely important here. It's the reason I'm giving it so much attention. It is built into the structure, but it's also built into the action of the play. What gave Oedipus his greatness in coming to Thebes was that he beat the Sphinx, okay? Absolutely the worst quiz show ever, okay? You get one question, And if you get it wrong, you get eaten. Okay. It, although I suspect if they put it on the air now, it would be hugely popular. The $10 million Sphinx. I mean, everybody would tune in. It would be big. Nobody else had beaten the Sphinx. And the riddle was this. This was the riddle of the Sphinx that nobody got. What walks on four legs in the morning, two legs at noon, and three legs in the evening? Okay? It's a good riddle. It's a wonderful riddle. Okay? So good, nobody got it. Oedipus gets it. And the answer, of course, is man. Crawls on all four as a baby. In his maturity, walks upright on two legs. And as an old man sinking toward the grave, hobbles on three legs with the added help of a wooden one, the cane. The answer to the Sphinx's riddle is man. The Sphinx is in despair. The quiz show host kills itself. Never dreamt there'd be a payoff. And Oedipus goes on to glory. But something very, very curious happens when Tiresias comes in, and there is the incredible encounter between Tiresias and Oedipus. And what Tiresias is doing is telling the truth to Oedipus again, directly. He doesn't want to do it. It's part of the great drama of the scene. He comes in and Oedipus says, "You've got to tell me, who's the murderer?" And Tiresias says, "Yeah, I know, but there's no way I'm going to tell you." Yes, of course, but forget it. If I tell you, I'm going to get such crap. Forget it. No way. And Oedipus is after him. "Tell me, tell me, tell me." And finally Tiresias says, "Okay, it's you." And Oedipus is in a rage and just starts attacking the old blind man. It's an astonishing moment. It's an astonishing moment. And we get a really nasty exchange between the king and the prophet. It's a wonderful scene. But Oedipus doesn't stop there. The old man is telling him things he doesn't want to know, and Oedipus keeps asking questions. Okay? Suddenly Tiresias brings up Oedipus's parents. Parents? Who? Wait, who is my father? Tell me more, tell me more. I just beat you over the head for telling me something. I didn't believe you. Now tell me more. What's going on here? Oedipus is clearly responding to the truth. It is human nature. How dare you say that to me? How dare you say that I'm like that? Tell me more about myself. We don't want the truth. We want the truth. It's our perverse nature. Parents, who? Wait, who is my father? This day will bring your birth and your destruction. Riddles! All you can say are riddles, murk and darkness. You know, speak straight. Tell me what you're actually talking about. "Ah, but aren't you the best man alive at solving riddles?" says Tiresias. Just, oh, slap! It's just, I got to tell you, it's drama doesn't get better than this. Two huge personalities just going at each other in wonderfully subtle, brilliant ways. "Mock me for that. Go on and you'll reveal my greatness." Pumped up full of pride. So full of himself. And then Tiresias turns the riddle on Oedipus. He's brought up his parents saying, "Hey, you want to know where as a baby you came from and what happened to you? Hey, look at you standing there now saying, what's the problem here in Thebes? You're the problem, Mr. Smart Guy." And then, before Tiresias leaves, he says, "A stranger, you may think, who lives among you, he soon will be revealed a native Theban, but he will take no joy in the revelation. Blind, who now has eyes. Beggar, who now is rich. He will grope his way toward a foreign soil, a stick tapping before him, step by step." And Tiresias gives a better answer to the Sphinx's riddle. Oedipus wins by saying it's man. Tiresias comes in and says, no, the answer to the riddle, Oedipus. you yourself, crawling helpless on all fours as a baby, proud and arrogant standing on your two legs. Get ready, Buster. You will tap your way out of Thebes, blinded with a stick in front of you. Oedipus is the answer to the riddle. He doesn't know it yet. He doesn't even realize that he got away with a good answer, but not the best answer. There's a better answer to the riddle. And suddenly, Oedipus, who's saying, find me the murderer, find me the truth, becomes his own Sphinx, having to answer his own riddle, at which point he must destroy himself. This play is just brilliantly constructed, absolutely overwhelming in its construction. the more you look at it, the more staggering the thing becomes. Now, I've got a few minutes remaining here. Let me do one other thing before I, this is out of sequence a bit. I'm going to fit it in here because it simply fits. When we come back, I'm going to begin the next lecture by looking at the choral odes and looking at the actual construction of the play, the way it's put together. Let me end this lecture by saying a few words about the nature of the chorus itself. I just mentioned it briefly, but let me give a thorough analysis. One of the points that I was trying to make yesterday about the nature of the Greek drama is that the Greek drama is communal. It was an entire citizenry turning out for this event. It was community worship. It was community drama. Everyone went, and these plays spoke to everyone. And indeed, you get that reflected in the plays themselves. Much of what this play is about Oedipus's position as king of Thebes and his relation to the community of Thebes. Turns out he was actually a child of Thebes. He is now the ruler of Thebes, and he will become the outcast of Thebes by the end of the play. None of this is possible without the people of Thebes, who are there throughout. The chorus in all of Greek drama is hugely important. And it's important, first and foremost, because it makes sense, not just grammatically, but it makes sense in terms of Athens' view of the city. And the chorus became the link between the action of the play and the citizens of the city watching the play. So that every Greek play has a chorus. And that chorus is usually comprised of citizens of the city where the play is set. Now that can vary. Aeschylus's Agamemnon, the first part of the Oresteia trilogy. We have the elders of Thebes. They're just the elders of Argos. They are simply the old men of Argos. Why just the old men? Because all the young men are off fighting at Troy. They're all off fighting at Troy. There are no young men around. And the city has become aged and is old, okay? So we have a chorus, it's citizens, but it's all the old guys. In Aristophanes' Lysistrata, the chorus is the elderly men and women of Athens. Again, all the young guys are off fighting the Peloponnesian War, but because Aristophanes' comedy is about the battle between the sexes, between men and women, he gives us a two-part chorus, and the chorus indeed divides at one point and goes to war themselves. The old men and the old women fighting on stage. It's a great comic scene. It's a wonderful comic scene. The old men are trying to break into the city treasury where the women have hidden themselves, and they pick up these big logs, and they're going to smash down the door. Well, they're too old and feeble to, forgive the expression, keep their logs up. And the old women are there mocking them, saying, you can't. Well, I won't go into it. It's pure Aristophanic comedy. It's wildly funny, okay? But we have the citizens, again, the citizens of Athens, but they reflect the play. Divided chorus, old men, old women, and there's a war between them. In this play, in Oedipus, it is simply the citizens of Thebes, and what's going on is the connection between the ruler and the ruled. It is all of them, okay? It is the citizenry. So the first function of the chorus is to be the connecting point between the audience and the action on the stage, the main story. The second function of the chorus is to somehow reflect for the audience what is happening in the action of the play. I mentioned already that one chorus where the chorus of Thebes dismisses the gods, dismisses prophecy. They are a barometer, okay? Not just a connection, but a barometer, telling us what's going on in the play and telling the citizens of the audience how they should be responding. They are a marker, if you will. They're a way an audience can understand or somehow feel what your average Athenian would be feeling in watching the play. Okay? So they're a barometer of the thoughts. They are also simply the voice of common sense often, of those of the voice of the massed citizens, if you would, as opposed to the greatness and the nobility of those who are being presented, okay? Please remember, the heroes in the play, Oedipus is about 8 feet tall. He's got those big catharnae on. He's got the three-foot tall platform shoes. He's a big guy. The chorus, they're walking on their own little bare pegs. It's your average Joe, not six pack, I guess, ouzo pack, whatever the equivalent would have been in Greece. Just simply what the average guy would be thinking and feeling. And then one other function, that is simply the great choral odes. They're the song and dance men. They are specially trained. They give the interludes. We have these intense scenes and then we get music, song, and the chorus had to dance, okay? In these plays, in the tragedies, very serious dance, as it would have been, but still movement, adding to that sense of spectacle Aristotle talks about. In the Aristophanes comedies, it could be almost anything. When I did the birds at the Naval Academy, I had a chorus of 20 in gigantic bird costumes, feathers everywhere, huge headdresses, big foam rubber feet, hiding tap shoes, and at one moment they all broke into Bye Bye Blackbird with top hats and canes, and all 20 of them were tap dancing up on the stage. It was a big musical number. It's probably the most stupid thing I've ever put on any stage, and I absolutely loved it. And the audience was just bewildered as to what was going on. the Greek chorus is unlike anything that the theater ever offered before, but it has many repercussions. O'Neill uses something like it in his play The Iceman Cometh. All those other figures sitting drunk in Harry Hope's bar become a kind of Greek chorus. There's no doubt that the choruses of Gilbert and Sullivan come out of the choruses of Aristophanes. So it's a long, proud theater tradition that begins here. When we come back, I'll talk about the structure of the action itself.